Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing good, man.
Well, everyone, today we have a special guest with us. Mark Kurlansky has written one of my favorite reads in the last several months. He is the James Beard Award-winning New York Times best-selling author of Cod, a biography of the fish that ate the world, Salt, a world history, many other books. He's written articles for the New York Times Magazine, Harper's, the International Herald Tribune. He's here to discuss his new and highly acclaimed book, The Big Oyster, History on the Half Shell. Mark, welcome to the show.
Nice to talk to you.
Now, before we talk about this particular book, Oyster, The Big Oyster, which I love, your books, Cod, Salt, Oysters, you really do pick a discrete topic and then write about it. Why is that? Is that how your mind works?
I guess so. Actually, those three particular books were all picked for different reasons, but, you know, all have in common that they're about a food commodity.
Mm-hmm. Which is why we read all three of them.
Right. But it's not why I wrote them, actually. I was trying to do very different things in all of them. But the main thing is I'm looking for a good story that tells something that I think is important.
Well, I think that with The Big Oyster, it's obvious, and we can talk about the other books another time, but it's pretty obvious that you take this discrete thing and you start with this small point, but it's really a number of things. I mean, is it more to this book, more a history of New York or a history of environmentalism and the Industrial Revolution?
Well, it's both of those. It's a history of New York. I realized that in telling the story of these oysters, you told the whole story of the development of New York, not only as a food center, but as a port and an economic center, and a lot about New York culture, but also, and maybe more importantly, it shows everything that's wrong with the way cities are developed.
Mm-hmm. I was just about to ask, you know, is there a message here that you want to get across through that you're stating kind of through the oyster?
Yeah, it's that, you know, cities don't have to exist in opposition to nature, that if they do, you know, we all lose. That they need to be developed in harmony with nature. New York City was grown on the site of a natural wonder that should have been preserved.
Well, so why don't you tell our listeners this, who may not have yet read the book, the story of the oyster and why it's so integral to the development and history of New York City?
Yeah, you know, in any previous century, if you had said that you were going to New York, people would have said, enjoy the oysters. It's what New York City was known for. When the first Europeans came to New York, there were huge piles of oyster shells that the Indians had left there. Some of them are still around and have been carbon dated to as old as 6,900 BC. So people on this spot have been eating oysters for a very long time. And it very quickly became a part of the New York way of life. And there were a lot of distinctly New York ways of eating oysters.
Like what?
Well, you could buy them from stands on any street corner, or you could go in the middle of the night to any one of a number of huge outdoor markets. You know, everybody talks about how you used to be able to go in Paris late at night and get onion soup at Les Halles. But you could go any time of night down to the Fulton Market or the Washington Market or a number of places and have an oyster stew or oysters on the half shell.
I just love the thought of the street vendors selling oysters. You know, could I have a pretzel and six dozen?
Yeah, they were incredibly cheap. there was a thing called the Canal Street Plan, which was all you could eat for 6 cents. And when hot dogs were first sold in Coney Island, they had trouble competing with oysters because for the price of one hot dog, you could get a dozen oysters.
Wow. Now,
things have changed a little there.
Yeah. I'm afraid so.
Now, the oysters that you're talking about are the East Coast oysters, were a specific type of oyster to New York?
No, not at all. It's one of the interesting things about the oyster is that, well, yes and no, I should say. If you look at the oysters from Louisiana all through the Gulf, around Florida, up the Chesapeake to New York to New England, all the way up to Newfoundland, they are all biologically identical, the exact same animal. Oysters are like wine grapes. They're determined by where they're grown.
Mm-hmm.
And you can grow them on one side of a cove or the other, and they will taste different, and they will have a different shape, and the shell will look different. Even though they're biologically the same animal, they're determined by the temperature of the water and the type of nutrients and the speed of current and the salinity. So that New York City in its heyday had, you know, more than a half dozen types of oysters, you know, Rockaways and Staten Island, mm-hmm. and East Rivers. And when the beds started to become exhausted in the early 19th century, they could go down to the Chesapeake and take seed oysters from the Chesapeake and replant the beds.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, you don't get a Chesapeake oyster. You get the same oyster that always grew there because it's the conditions that define the oyster.
Right. We name our oysters based on where they're from.
Right.
Like a red Burgundy, and you say this in your book, like a red Burgundy is a red Burgundy, a Chesapeake oyster is a Chesapeake oyster, or a Blue Point oyster is a Blue Point oyster.
Yeah, well, they've been for a long time now, they've been playing a bit fast and loose with the name Blue Point, but I mean, the Blue Point is the name of a town in the Great South Bay, and I keep running into Blue Points from everywhere but Blue Point.
Well, I think that what's interesting now is that oysters are not inexpensive, especially to get them handled well. And the thing about oysters is they need to be kept ice and they need to be kept cold. How in the time when oysters were everywhere, how were they kept cold and fresh?
Well, you eat oysters alive, and as long as an oyster is alive, it's fresh and good. We tend to think of them as delicate, but they're really not. They have this very thick shell, and unusual in nature, they're two halves, not the same. They have a cup shell and a flat shell, and if you store them with the cup shell down so that the liquor stays in them and keep them in a reasonably cool place, and get them to clamp really tightly shut, they'll be good for two or 3 weeks. In the 19th century, New York City oysters were shipped by train to Denver and San Francisco.
Holy cow.
And by ship to Europe.
Mark, we have to take a small break. We'll come back and talk more about the oyster. Some of the most magical things to come out of the sea are in oyster shells. Mark Kurlansky is author of the book, The Big Oyster: History on the Half Shell. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, you're back with Mark and Francis of Catherine Lombardi and Stage Left Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And our guest today is Mark Kurlansky. He's written the excellent book, The Big Oyster, History on the Half Shell. It's about oysters in New York. We were talking before the break about how oysters keep pretty well as long as you eat them alive. What happens to an oyster when it dies that you can't eat it?
Well, the first thing that happens is that it opens. The oyster's natural position is open, and they have to exert effort to close. So when they die, they just they open up and very quickly lose their liquor and deteriorate.
Well, now I think one of the great things about oysters to me are very sexy food. I mean, there's a place called Blue Ribbon that's not too far from our restaurant that I can leave my restaurant at 11 o'clock at night and be at 11:40 with a dozen oysters in front of me and a beer in my hand. And this is one of the great joys of my life is late night oyster eatings. But you write about in your book a lot about the culture of the oyster, and along with Along with oyster eating, always went drinking, and oysters were considered an aphrodisiac. What is it that is culturally so significant about the oyster, especially around New York?
Well, I mean, one of the things, in fact, was that it was associated with prostitution, which was the other thing, the other famous New York product.
Okay, how was it associated with prostitution?
Oyster cellars, cellars with a C, C-E-L-L-A-R, were these unique New York restaurants that were in basements and served almost exclusively oysters and lots of alcohol. And
they do go well together.
Right. And the other thing that was felt to go well with them was ladies of the night.
I've never tried that combination.
Well, it was very popular in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
If all of this wasn't clear enough, oyster cellars were marked by a huge red light in front of
interesting.
The stairway.
Hmm. I got it. I've got it now. Now, you talk – so we had the oyster in New York making up a large part of the culture of New York and what got eaten in New York. But you said before in the last segment that oysters were shipped to the Midwest. Oysters were shipped to Europe. They were a delicacy around the world. There was a real economic engine around the oyster in New York.
Oh, yeah. And if you look at newspapers in different Western towns like San Francisco and Denver, when around the time when rail links were completed to the East Coast, you will find ads that say, coming soon, fresh New York oysters. The oyster business expanded with the expansion of the Port of New York, so that when Robert Fulton did the first steamboat run, which was from the East River to Albany, oysters were then sold upstate. And when the Erie Canal was dug, they were sold farther into the Midwest, and when the railroad was built, they were sold to the West, and when transatlantic crossings got shorter because of clipper ships and then steam power, they sold oysters to Europe. It was a very famous product, a New York City oyster, and it was in demand everywhere.
So why do you think that oysters are so attractive? And I mean, we're talking about a period of time, 9,000 years that people have been eating oysters. We're talking about people from all different cultures eating oysters. People from all around the world have been eating oysters for a really, really long time. Why do you think that is?
Well, especially because they don't have...
Tastes are so different around the world.
Because they don't have very much nutritional value.
Right. I mean, it fascinated me that the Indians that were here, the Lenni Lenape, ate a lot of oysters because they were hunter-gatherers. You know, and Manhattan had elk and deer and hundreds of different types of fish. And these are things that are very easy to catch and have a very... high level of protein and nutrition and a large amount of meat for a small amount of effort. The reverse is true of oysters. You know, it's
right.
A lot of effort and a very small amount of meat and not particularly high protein meat at that.
And even after you catch them, you still got to get into that shell.
Right. We don't even know how they did it before Europeans, because no pre-European tool has ever been found in the Northeast that was capable of opening an oyster. And it's very interesting to me that they, you know, you have to ask, so why did these hunter-gatherers bother with oysters? And, you know, the only possible conclusion is that for the same reason that we do, they liked them.
They're yummy. And they couldn't, and they couldn't have a beer at Blue Ribbon while they were...
And I think I may have a solution for how they might have gotten them open. As a little kid, I remember going to Long Island, and the gulls would go and they would catch clams and oysters and things like that, which were relatively abundant at that time, right off the seashore. And they would go and catch them, and then they'd fly really, really, really high in the air, and then they'd drop them.
On a rock.
On something hard.
Yeah, but the problem with that is that these piles of shells that they left behind are intact.
Wow.
So they weren't dropping them from large rocks.
They weren't dropping them. It's thought that possibly they were heating them.
Mm-hmm. Oh. So now how big were these piles of shells from long ago?
Some of them are many feet deep.
Uh-huh.
There were huge ones all over the place. Only a few are left, but they were a very common sight all over the New York area.
I think one of the interesting things in your book, Mark, was you're funny, and you know it's this could be a very dry subject, but it's really funny and fun. And you talk about how the oysterman years ago would starfish are a predator for oysters, and so the oysterman would gather up all the starfish, cut them in half to kill them, and then throw them back in the water.
Right, but thereby making twice as many starfish.
But of
right.
course, they're starfish, so they just
know.
Regenerate.
They didn't know that.
Oystermen hate starfish. Yeah, starfish just kind of wraps itself onto an oyster and drills a hole and just sucks it out. And could they kill lots of oysters?
Yeah, I would think that today's oysterman would just use a paper shredder.
Yeah. our guest is Mark Kurlansky. His book is The Big Oyster, History on the Half Shell. We'll be talking more with him in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standard set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, back to the Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurant. Our guest today is Mark Kurlansky. He's written many wonderful books, and today we're talking about his book, The Big Oyster, History on the Half Shell, which you can pick up. We'll link you to that book on our site, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll tell you how to get it. It's a fabulous read about what sounds like it might be a dry topic by just looking at the title, but it's really awesome. One of the interesting facts that I culled from the book was you said that you presented a fact in your book that if one were to derive their necessary caloric intake from oysters, you'd have to eat 250 oysters a day?
Yeah.
Would you also have to drink 9 beers?
Well, that would help.
All right, so nutrition, a great nutritional source, it's not for the amount of work. You probably expend more calories in getting the oyster than you achieve by eating the oyster.
Yeah, and yet people have always, you know, even hunter-gatherers, everybody has always eaten oysters. I think it's a unique food.
You know, and it's also unique in that, I mean, it's a love it or hate it kind of thing, because the fine line between excellent and disgusting is encapsulated in an oyster, because it's really sort of slimy and salty and somewhere between the most perfect seafood in the world and snot. So, I mean, wouldn't you agree?
Well, I'm not sure I'd put it that way, but I see your point.
But, I mean, people either love oysters or won't go near them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it is this very unique taste that really isn't like anything else. And you know, even when you are a regular oyster eater like I am, there's always some almost a moment of shock mm-hmm. when you taste an oyster. It just there's something unexpectedly poignant in the taste of an oyster.
And at the same time, a bad oyster, there's nothing like a bad oyster.
Yeah. But, you know, there aren't that many bad oysters around. I've been a big oyster eater all my life and have only once experienced a bad oyster.
I actually like the smaller oysters better.
Well, I do, too.
I'm sorry, you said big oyster eater.
And what that is about is that the warmer the water, the faster oysters grow.
Mm-hmm.
And it's generally been determined that the economically viable formula is 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's about as long as an oysterman can afford to invest in growing an oyster. So a three-year-old oyster from warm water is much larger than a three-year-old oyster from cold water.
Mm-hmm.
So the small oysters that you eat are usually from cold water. And they tend to be much stronger and brinier in flavor, which appeals to a lot of people. Appeals to me.
Appeals to me.
Yeah, I'm that guy.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, we're going to put on our website, restaurantguysradio.com, we're going to put a link to the Big Oyster, Mark Kurlansky, as well as to a couple of Mark and my favorite oyster joints. And we're going to take a small break from the news, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with Mark Kurlansky, author of The Big Oyster, about what happened to this huge oyster beds in New York that no longer are there, and maybe what lessons we can learn from that. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Today our guest is Mark Kurlansky. He's the James Beard Award-winning New York Times best-selling author of several books, including Cod, a biography of the fish that ate the world, Salt, a world history. And the book we're talking about today is his wonderful book called The Big Oyster, History on the Half Shell. It's a book about the oyster and the history of New York. Now, before the news, Mark, we were talking about how important oysters were and how many oysters there were in and around New York City. Then what happened?
Well, there were always epidemics in New York, cholera and typhoid, very regularly, and people didn't understand a lot about what caused diseases, and it was widely believed that these diseases were caused by immigrants, you know, because if you were listening to Congress last week, people who were born in other countries are always supposed to be a menace.
That's what I've heard.
Right.
Mm-hmm. My Irish grandparents would not agree, but that's what I heard.
Yeah. Well, many of these were Irish. There was something like half the city was born in Ireland in the 19th century. And
damn Irish. I'm sorry, go ahead.
But we digress. So in 1855, there was an epidemic that unusually did not attack poor people and in the slums, and a number of notable New Yorkers died of cholera, and then they thought, well, what's going on here? Maybe it's the oysters. But it was called the oyster panic, and for a few weeks nobody ate oysters, but then the epidemic passed and everybody forgot about it because they didn't understand what caused diseases. Mm-hmm. Pasteur said that they were caused by germs, but, you know, it was called the germ theory. It was just this theory,
right,
that some French guy came up with, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
another foreigner.
Right.
Especially French.
Right.
So.
And then in the 1880s, they started identifying the actual germs that caused these diseases. And by the 1890s, when there was an outbreak, they could trace it to its origin. And every time there was an outbreak in New York, it was traced to one shellfish bed or another.
Really?
And you know, probably for a very long time, these beds had been causing these diseases because raw sewage had been dumped into the water onto these, you know, shellfish beds going back to Dutch times.
And that's not good for shellfish?
Well, it came as a great shock to discover that, you know, centuries of dumping raw sewage on your food supply is unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they found this in a shell bed, they would close that bed down. Now, you know, there's a couple of curious things here. You know, why didn't they just test all the shell beds at once? Instead of
waiting for someone to get sick?
Right. It was a 30-year process from the early 1890s to 1927. The last bed, Raritan Bay, between Staten Island and New Jersey was closed.
Right. We are on the banks of the Raritan River, which feeds into the Raritan Bay right here. Oh,
a one-time big oyster producer, but towards the mouth.
Now, another wonderful statistic that I culled from your book. Now, it seems as though oysters are very important to the ecology of of any water body. I think you said something like it's 50. An oyster can pump 55 gallons of water a day.
Yeah.
And the original population of oysters in the New York Harbor would filter all of the water in the New York Harbor in a matter of 3 days.
Right.
Really amazing.
You know, when Hudson arrived, the water must have been incredibly clear. You must have been able to see clear to the bottom.
They eat
algae and all these impurities that are in the water and then pump it out clean.
And so when the oyster beds closed, why did the native oysters, it became too polluted for them to even exist?
Not originally. Originally, when they were closed, it's just that you got sick if you ate them. But then the water got much worse, and it got to the point where oysters couldn't even live in them because, typically New York City water bubbled like molten lava from all these gases and things, and there were lots of places like the Gowanus Canal and the Passaic River where the Kilvin Cull was another where buildings that were near the water, the paint peeled from toxic fumes rising out of the water.
You write about in your book, you paint a great story about how in Staten Island people would go into the kills and look at, there was a layer of thick sludge on the bottom that was so thick that when it would warm up in the summer, bubbles the size of basketballs would float to the surface from the sludge, and you could watch the sea boil and spit.
Yeah, it was just terrible stuff, and all the oysters died. And then along in 1970 came the Clean Water Act, which mandated that all the waters of New York City become swimmable and fishable. And they are today.
So in your book, you wrote that today all the Hudson Rivers and almost all the waters in New York Harbor are swimmable and most of the fish are catchable. Do you think it's possible that one day New York could return to the oyster capital it once was, that oysters could return?
Well, something has to be done first. There's a ton of, actually, I think several tons.
I was going to say a lot of tons.
Right? Of PCBs and some heavy metals. And, this is stuff that oysters can't eat away. But you'll eat it if you eat the oyster.
Right, the PCBs are a real problem.
And the heavy metals aren't good for you either.
Right, and they have to be cleaned up, and I believe it's been court mandated that General Electric do a cleanup because they put them in, and there's a lot of legal wrangling going on. And
is it possible to clean out heavy metals and PCBs from the water in a sufficient way that we could again have oysters in the that we could eat?
It's a big argument, it seems like, yeah, it would be possible. It would be expensive.
You get to take a side, Mark. Go ahead. Which side of the argument are you on?
I'm on the side of cleaning it up. This stuff is really unhealthy, and New York could return to an oyster industry and fisheries and. And also we wouldn't be poisoned, which would be nice.
That'd be nice. Now, are there still factories along the various rivers? Is pollution still entering the water?
Possibly in some small way, but, officially, no.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, what's funny is another thing that I enjoyed reading is that there are many people who are proposing that we introduce more and more oysters into the Raritan Bay, into the various tributaries and rivers around the area, not so that they'll be eaten, because, of course, they'll still have the PCBs and the heavy metals, but just for their cleansing properties, that they will help restore the water. Is that a good idea?
It's a great idea. Oysters are just really good for water.
Mm-hmm.
It's this natural filtration process that you don't have to do anything. The oysters just do it.
That's what they are. They're little filters.
Yes.
That's their whole life.
And then, of course, that's the problem with eating them is that you're eating a raw filter.
Yeah. Yeah. You better be sure it's pretty clean water. Well, anyway, Mark, I want to thank you for coming on the show. Your book is amazing. We're going to put a link to it up on our website. I recommend that people buy it if you're interested in food at all, or if you're interested in ecology, or if you just like a good read in history. I think it's pretty amazing.
Thank you very much. Fun talking to you.
Likewise.
Thanks, Mark.
Take care.
Bye.
That was Mark Kurlansky. His book is called Big Oyster, History on the Half Shell. It's a great history of New York. It's about the history of New York. It's about society. It's about drinking and eating and Lenape Indians.
Yeah, I think when you see the Big Oyster, you think that it's going to be a book all about oysters, but it's really a book about what's happened in New York.
And it's amazing how you see it from the point of view of an oyster. Well, you know, oysters don't have eyes, but well, you know what I mean. Anyway, we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1145. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Catherine Lombardi and Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And today we're talking about oysters. Oysters are some of my favorite foods. One of my favorite foods? I don't know how that works. Mark Kurlansky's book is The Big Oyster, History on the Half Shell. It's a great read. And I wasn't kidding when I say that one of my favorite things to do is after work. Sure, there's something about oysters at midnight, and Blue Ribbon's a place in Manhattan. There's one in Brooklyn as well, where I go, and they serve until 4 in the morning. Cold, clean, and I like my oysters on the half shell. You know what I like on them? Nothing. Get away from my oyster.
I like a little like vinaigrette or mignonette, just a tiny little bit of onion or a little bit of spice, just a teeniest, tiniest little bit, just to kind of make the flavors of the oyster kind of pop out. That's the way I would have an oyster, given my druthers. And the other thing is, one of the things that Mark was talking about when he was on the show, how important where the oyster comes from. We all call our oysters based on where they're from, whether it's from, you know, Kumamoto oysters or Blue Point oysters or Malbec oysters. It's all about where the oyster's from, because that's because of the, and like he was saying, because of the tides and the temperature of the water and the things in the water, that's what gives an oyster its flavor. That's what where the oyster's different textures and flavors come from.
Well, because it basically concentrates whatever is there in the water.
That's what it does. That's what oysters do.
Here's the deal, though.
It's the taste of the sea.
It is the taste of the sea. Here's the deal. Tartar sauce.
And if your sea is the Black Sea, well.
Tartar sauce, keep it away from my oyster.
You're not a big fan of tartar. I'm not a big fan of tartar sauce, even on my fish and chips.
Get away from my oyster. That is designed for like a mediocre oyster that you want to disguise the taste of. But an interesting thing to do if you don't have an oyster knife, and opening oysters at home, it's a skill. And they actually sell these chainmail gloves, which, because you're opening an oyster, you have to use such pressure with this very hard knife, not necessarily a sharp knife, that you can really stab yourself and do some real damage.
And those chainmail gloves, they work. I mean, you're still gonna, you know, you still have the impact of the oyster knife hitting your hand, and it will still hurt.
But you don't have the insertion into your tendons.
But you don't have a cut, which is a big thing.
But the other way to open oysters that is just very simple at home. Oysters have two sides. They have a flat shell and they have a bowl shell. You always want to store your oysters bowl side down so the liqueur stays in the juice stays in the oyster. And if you want to open oysters at home, you can just pop them in the oven. Put them on a sheet tray. Put them in the oven at 350 degrees and wait for them to open up.
For not very long. I mean, you don't have to cook the oyster through to get the oyster to open.
And you don't want, and Americans always want stuff hot. I mean, if you go to restaurants in Europe, even the soup is not like piping hot. That's an American thing. We need things hot, 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 or cold, cold, cold. And a warm oyster is just that. It's a warm oyster.
Can I tell you something?
What?
I don't really care for warm oysters. I love my, like you were just saying, Americans like cold, cold, cold. I love my oysters when they're chilly, chilly, like they've just come out of 42-degree waters. Like the, I mean, I like my oyster to be nice and cold and to be sitting there on a nice bed of ice when it comes out. And that's when I feel that an oyster's really been taken care of.
I take it both ways, oysters. And the thing about the warm oysters, though, is if you're home and you don't have an oyster knife, it's an easy way to open the oyster. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing you want to remember. This may gross you out, may not gross you out, is that an oyster is still alive when you eat it. And if an oyster is dead, you don't want to eat it.
Can I tell you, I love oysters. It still grosses me out. It's the only food that we eat while it's still alive. The only food in the world that we eat while it's still alive.
The only food that I eat while it's still alive. Okay, places to go in New York City to have an oyster. Blue Ribbon. Blue Ribbon in Manhattan on Sullivan and Spring. We'll put this up on our website. The Oyster Bar at Grand Central is a beautiful, beautiful place in Grand Central Station where you can get great oysters. And those are probably my two favorite. If you're a restaurateur, and we get so many restaurateurs that listen to the show, oysters are dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not dangerous in that they're going to make somebody sick. They're dangerous in that you're going to lose money. Oysters are fairly expensive, and you need to have a demand. If you're going to serve raw oysters in an oyster bar, you need to have a demand for oysters to move them, because that's something that really has to be fresh and keep
moving. I'll say one of the things that Mark said is that oysters will stay alive 2 to 3 weeks. That's true. They will stay alive 2 to 3 weeks, but they will get worse every day that you have them, just like any other food. The longer they're out of the water, the longer they're out of their element, as it were, the worse those oysters are going to get. And just having had oysters that were 5 days old versus oysters that had come out of the water 3 hours ago, there's a huge difference.
I agree. The other thing we're going to put up on our website is there's oysters Rockefeller. I really, when you go out to a restaurant and you get oysters Rockefeller, it's never made, well, rarely made to order. Beautiful presentation, old classic presentation. It's too much, especially if you're not using a fresh oyster on the half shell.
Well, in restaurant cooking, and people should know what happens in restaurant cooking. Generally, if you're not getting a fresh oyster on the half shell, how restaurants buy oysters is in a big old can. And the oysters are shucked, and the oysters are in that can and preserved and could be in that can for a really long time. They're canned oysters, just like you have canned anything else.
Peas.
They're canned oyster, canned peas.
Worse.
I don't know if they're worse than canned peas. I really despise canned peas. But just like anything else that's canned, realize that that's going to be an inferior product to the fresh product, to a fresh oyster.
The interesting thing about oysters, we're just oyster mania here right now. But another interesting thing that differentiates oysters from most other food is that farmed oysters are generally better than wild oysters, than oysters grown in the wild. And one of the reasons you have that is oysters basically adhere to any shape and take on the shape of whatever it is they adhere to. Like, they'll adhere to a shoe on the bottom of the ocean. And so if you were to get a dozen wild oysters that you went out and picked somewhere.
Shoe-shaped oysters?
Yeah, you would have oysters, 12 different sizes. They'll grow to as long as a banana and about the same thinness. When you have an oysterman who lays down an oyster bed of oyster shells, what they do is they all compete. Or they're laid out evenly on this oyster bed.
Right,
and so they're all about the same size and about the same shape. And frankly, the truly wild oysters that you would forage for and the farmed oysters taste just about the same.
Just about the same. They really do, as long as they're coming from the same waters.
People talk, though, about, when we talked with Mark, about what kind of oysters you like. I like small oysters. I like oysters from cold water.
Yeah, I'm a cold water oyster guy all the
because
way.
Because if you're using oysters in recipes, there are two different kinds. There are two broad strokes of oyster flavors. There are the creamy oysters, and there are the briny oysters. And the briny oysters are like this pungent, like sharp taste of the sea. And then you get that from the north. You get that from around Long Island. You get that from up here. Down from the south, like around New Orleans, you get these big, fat oysters, and they're really creamy.
Hate those.
Hate them. Can't stand them.
You know what I would like to do when we come back from break? Let's talk about the seasonality of oysters. Might be nice to tell people how things have changed and how things are a little bit the same.
Months with an R. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, you're back with The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we are here talking today. We're talking about oysters mostly. And there was an old adage I remember when I was growing up. My mom used to say that you can only get oysters that you can only eat oysters in a month that has an R in it. because you couldn't get oysters in the summertime.
If the water was too warm off the coast of New Jersey and New York, you shouldn't eat the oysters.
And things have sort of changed around a little bit because oysters come. You can get oysters all year round in New York.
And from all over.
And from all over. That's really cool. Hey, listen, as we approach the end of the hour, I want to cover one email that we got from a guy named Ed, and Ed writes us from Canada. He says, I listen to the show regularly. Great job. I have apparently taken leave of my faculties. I left my real job, and I'm opening a restaurant. Thanks for the honest talk and some great nuggets. No, really. That's Ed from Toronto. Ed, yes, you did. Sorry about that.
Ed, I think tomorrow maybe we'll talk a little bit about the reasons that you shouldn't open a restaurant.
But if you're going to, some things that you should look out for.
I think that's a good idea. We should spend some time on that tomorrow.
We've had a number of emails from people like that, and I think it's interesting being in the ownership of a small restaurant, because even if you had a bit of, if you're a chef or a sommelier or a GM or a maitre d' of an operation, you don't see the whole thing. And we've been talking to one of our friends who's planning on opening a restaurant soon, and we'll talk about some of the hidden things that you may not think of, and I think that we'll answer a bunch of questions when it comes to that. I have more news, though.
Hold on. I just want to give an oyster fact that we didn't cover just a minute ago. Just something that I think, obviously, if you own a restaurant, and our restaurant owners know this, but all the oysters and shellfish that we buy from wherever are tagged from where they come from.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark was talking earlier in the show about the fact that, you know, certain problems they found in oysters and certain oyster beds. And one of the reasons that we tag them is should someone get sick, we have to hold those for at least 90 days, and we have to hold those tags so that they can trace exactly where the oysters came from immediately. And that's always been fascinating to me.
It's the only food that you have to do that with. When your bag of oysters comes in, it comes in with a very durable tag, not a paper, but like a very durable canvas tag on it that you are required to keep. And what you do is you have a hanger in the kitchen, and you put the old one, you put the new one in, and then the old ones that'll come out the back. And we've kept track of where all of the stuff comes from.
The actual beds that the oysters
come from. So if anybody gets sick in any restaurant, and that doesn't happen very much from oysters. I mean, that was a problem in the past, but they're very careful about where oysters come from now, so you don't have an oyster bed under the sewage treatment plant, you know. But if anything should happen, there's a great deal of care taken to have those oysters be traceable and trackable.
It's one of the most traceable foods in the whole world, where you can see exactly where they've come from.
Especially around here. Anyway, oysters, great. Love them. All the rumors about them being dangerous. Haven't experienced it. I eat thousands of oysters a year.
Not yet.
Very healthy, very happy. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed this last hour talking with the restaurant guys. The book is The Big Oyster, History on the Half Shell. The author is Mark Kurlansky. He was our guest today. We're going to put the book up on the website where you can go check it out. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.